Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's a day for music and dance. Professional dancer Helen Simoneau arrived here in the Triad as a teenager from a tiny village in Quebec, Canada. Now she's dancing all over the world, sharing her original choreography and insights into the art of movement. Then it's the art of canon and counterpoint. Nobody did it better than Bach, and few appreciate that more than Centenary United Methodist Church Director of Music and the Arts, Robert Frazier. His vanity plates read J.S. Bach. He's bringing the best of Bach to Centenary, and you'll hear it first right here. Then, from the complexity of counterpoint to Karoff at the keyboard and the powerful simplicity of a prelude by Frédéric Chopin. And we wrap things up today with a triad woman whose work on the podium has been inspiring young North Carolinian singers for more than 30 years. Greensboro Youth Chorus director Ann Doyle is here to celebrate that group's quarter century mark next on Triad Arts Weekend after this news. Dancer Helen Simoneau was born and raised in a small village of 1,000 people in Quebec and somehow made her way to Winston-Salem, North Carolina via the UNC School of the Arts as a high school student. What Helen lacked in formal training up to that point in her life, she more than made up for in hard work and dedication to her art while in school. That effort, along with the mentorship she received at UNCSA throughout high school and college, has come to fruition in her award-winning solo dance work and critically acclaimed company, Helen Simoneau Dance. The Winston-Salem and New York-based group performs regularly at Hanesbrands Theater, and this week, Helen and her work are representing Montreal. It's part of a month-long tour to Canada, Tokyo, and Korea, with residencies and performances scheduled at each location. She's presenting her new work, Flight Distance 3, Chain Suite, as part of the International Dance X Tour, alongside works by her colleagues in Japan and South Korea. Helen's Flight Distance 3 is a duet that she'll be performing with UNCSA alumna Kristen Taylor. Helen dropped by just before setting sail for Asia to talk about it. What was your big takeaway from your experience at UNCSA in the dance program?
That hard work really pays off, and that sounds maybe cliche, but it was definitely the truth for me because I came to the program, they really took a chance on me. I did not know my right from my left. I had very little dance experience. I just really loved it. I knew that I loved it, but I didn't have a lot of the training that my other classmates had. And so I was starting really from scratch, and it was clumsy at times. But I had a faculty that believed in me, and they always kept giving me information and helping me and rooting for me. And I felt like I really thrived in that environment. But it really hinged on the fact that I was very much ready to do the work, and I was willing to put those hours in and do the extra work outside of class to make it happen. And I worked really hard the whole time.
It seems like that sort of experience would be invaluable in terms of teaching.
Yeah, exactly. It also really made me realize when I started teaching that it doesn't always matter where the student is right at the beginning. It's the potential, and to really focus on the potential of the student and not already determine how far they can go based on where they are.
Yeah, and that's something that some teachers have a very difficult time giving off, that freedom. You can believe it intellectually, but if internally you don't believe it, you know, like you're going to pick the stars, the prodigies, and they're going to make it, the others aren't, it can be devastating for a young student.
Yeah.
To get
and they can feel it.
Yeah. From UNCSA, we can go all over the world with Helen Simoneau. Austria, Brazil, Canada, France, Greece, your work's been performed all over the world. Can you generalize in terms of how your work is received or the feedback you get from one part of the world to the next, or is it just a grab bag wherever you go?
I definitely feel like there's a difference in the audience reaction, what you can feel from the audience in different cities and different countries.
Uh-huh.
And I think it also depends on like what work that I perform, because I have some things that are quieter and some things that are more physical. But there is one solo work that I've performed in a lot of different cities, and that's been interesting in seeing the reaction of, it's a very quiet solo and requires concentration for the audience. And I've noticed that like when I performed it in Germany, it was like you could hear a pin drop. Like there was just like so much attention. And then even at the end, it's like they didn't want to clap until they knew for sure that it was over. And so there was a bit of a pause. Yeah. It was just so respectful. And then when they did start clapping, it was like, I mean, I went to the wings and I came back out like 3 or 4 times because they just kept going. And it was just like such a euphoric feeling.
Interesting.
But then in other places, it's funny and it's just a different experience. Like in Greece, when I performed there, people were, I think they received it well, but they were very, I guess, they expressed it well during the performance, what they were they were talking throughout.
Yelled it out?
I mean, they were like, I don't know if they were saying words, but they were making sounds and like, oh, and like things like, mm.
Is that disarming on stage when you're hearing that?
I wasn't ready for it, but yeah. I quickly figured out that that was the deal. So I just kind of, you know, went with it. But it was kind of nice because I it's not that it was just a different way of viewing work. And I felt from the sounds that they were making that they were actually engaged. So
yeah, well, that's the bottom line. Flight Distance 3 Chain Suite. Choreographing 13 minutes of movement strikes me as being just insanely difficult. I have no point of entree into that world. Talk me through the beginnings of this work and your creative process.
Well, the process for this work was in collaboration with the composer. So I worked with Jonathan Melville Pratt, who I know from college. He does a lot of work for different choreographers, mainly in New York. This was the first time, actually, I worked with him. And what we did is that I started on my end, and he started on his end. We talked a little bit about the mood or the type of sound that, you know, I was interested in. But then from there, we both created and then came together at one, like, at a midpoint, basically. And, you know, I was inspired by what he did and set some of the structures of the choreography based on his decision-making. And then I also asked him, you know, I really love this part, but I want to do it for the solo, which happens earlier in the piece. Could you move that? Would that be okay if we did this? And so he shifted things around based on some things that I needed for the piece, some structure mainly for the piece.
Had he just given you some thematic elements or an entire block of 13 minutes of sound? What were you given in terms of the audio initially?
At first, it was like a 5 minutes of trying different ideas. So it wasn't like a piece, a 5 minute piece. It was 5 minutes of like a reduced version of what he was going to maybe do for the entire work. So just to see what sounds I was attracted to, and then also of what sounds I really hated. So that he was like, just tell me what you don't like and I'll take it out. Sometimes we don't know what we want until we, you know what we don't want.
Does that go both ways? Does he ever say, you know, that gesture just doesn't strike you with this piece of, or this sound, or that?
No, it doesn't go both ways.
That's why it's the Helen Cimino dance.
No, because I commissioned him, so I get to, you know, I get to do all the movement, and he helps me. He's there to support.
Where's the joy in that process as it's been described so far for you? What part of that collaboration do you enjoy the most?
For me, it gets really exciting when things start to come together. So when I basically have a first draft, because a lot of times I'll work in, like, I'll make a little section here and a little section here. And sometimes, you know, I don't really know what the order of those sections is going to be and how one informs the other. So the first time that I string it together is, I think, where it gets really exciting for me, because then it really feels like something, it's really tangible, all the work, all the labor is right in front of me. And then I can actually start what I feel is like the art making at that point is really making those directorial decisions about what goes where and how the mood shifts from one thing to another.
Transitions.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a lot of editing that goes on from that point, or are all the elements there and it's just a matter of plugging them in where they belong, or do you wind up cutting a lot from that point for once you've got it all out on the table?
I think for this piece, I didn't end up cutting a lot. For this piece, I had a pretty clear idea. I mean, I was also only dealing with two bodies. One of them is my own. And so that makes it a lot quicker, a lot more efficient as far as like having extra material. There wasn't a lot that we didn't use for this piece. However, when I do other works, especially larger groups, we make a lot of material. And then I go in and select and pull. And there's a lot of things that just don't end up making it into the final version.
Now, you and Kristen have danced together many times before, but this, are you having to then cater some of the movement to her strengths when you're going about the choreography initially?
I definitely consider what I know she does well in my movement choices. And also, there are also moments where, you know, I've given her a task and she generates movement. So specifically for her solo in this duet, I gave each of us a task and then we separately worked on it and then directed her from the outside of it. But she essentially generated the material for that solo work. That's within the piece. And then that, of course, you know, what she does well just comes out. But then for the rest of the piece, I always had her in mind when I was making the material. But with Kristen, you don't really have to, like, work to her strengths because everything she does just looks amazing. She is just really a great mover, and she can do like very trained, very technical things, and then she can also do a lot of like very physical floor work, and she also never gets tired. So
tell me about this tour, and I mean, this is not just bopping around the Triad. This is a huge tour.
Yeah, it's very exciting. They invited me to do this about a year ago. And I have a relationship with Tangente because I performed the solo I was talking about earlier. I performed it there it was a few years ago, and just developed a relationship with the two directors that are there. And they have this tour. They do it every other year. And this is, I think, the third, I believe, year that they've done it. Mm. And the idea is that they have a partner in Japan, a venue in Japan that they're affiliated with. And then there's a venue in Busan, South Korea that they're affiliated with as well. These three venues have come together to create a tour. And the idea is that they select an artist from each place. Now, they're making a bit of an exception because I'm not currently living in Montreal, but I'm representing Montreal for this tour, and there's an artist from Tokyo who's also performing in the work, and an artist from Korea who's also performing in the work. So another thing that's really interesting is we're all doing duets, and all the choreographers are performing in the work. And that was not, I think, the mission of the tour, but it's sort of what ended up happening. And the idea is that not just to present our work internationally, which is, of course, a huge opportunity, but the presenters wanted to select artists that were up and coming, like emerging, trying to assist us, basically, in widening our audience. So as we go to these different cities, we're going to also be speaking to different presenters and having an opportunity to network a little bit while we're there. And then at the end, we have a residency. So we have a one-week residency with each other. So we'll get a chance to work creatively after having been together for 4 weeks.
When you're not in it, you're just sitting in the audience. Are you more nervous in the audience than you are up on stage?
Definitely. It's a lot harder for me to not be in the work. Mm. But it's necessary for me to feel like I understand the work from the audience's perspective. So in the larger group works that I make, and by say large, I mean like for me, it's like five, six people. I very much like to be on the outside, and I don't like to put myself in it because I don't have a good sense of what's happening. But once we get to the performance and I'm in the audience and there's nothing I can do at that point. And also as far as technical things can happen, there can be mistakes with the lighting or with the sound, and there's really nothing I can do at that point. Mm. So it's a very kind of uncomfortable place to be until the piece is over.
Getting that objectivity then from the audience and looking at your work as a choreographer, being in the audience, and how often do you have to revisit? That gesture didn't really work from this perspective. Mm-hmm. And is that pretty common?
That's a really good question, yeah. I think it's never finished. I think at a certain point, I will maybe not be so, after work has been performed a lot of times, I may not be so interested in the work as much anymore. Like, I'm ready to move on to something new. So I will stop. Like, I will stop working on it. But essentially, every performance that we have, I always want to go back in and tweak this or change that. And ultimately, every time I watch it, there's always going to be some things that I want to adjust. And sometimes having space between, if I haven't seen the work in a while, yeah, and we come back to it, then I'm in a different place, in my career. I feel I have different ideas. And so it changes the work. So I think that it gets to a certain point where the work is never finished. But I sometimes am finished with the work. But like with solo work, it's a different thing altogether, because I find that as well as making compositional choices, I'm also making performative choices. I mean, also with the duet that I perform with Kristen. But with the solo work, one of the things that's so easy is that I often will, in performance, make some discoveries or find something, like a moment that just anchors me or anchors that one gesture, and I'll save it. And so every time that my solo work gets performed, I feel like every performance becomes an opportunity for research. So I'm, of course, like completely enjoying being on stage, but at the same time, I'm finding new things that without the audience there, it's just not the same. Those discoveries like present themselves.
Could you define the anchor for me? What could that be?
It's sometimes just like what I think about when I do this one gesture or that gesture. And then I realize that, you know, through this this one solo that I've performed, probably the work that I've performed the most up to this point, where there are places where in the solo where I just have a narrative actually that goes on for myself in order to make my performance richer. I have a narrative that goes on throughout the entire thing. But when I started performing it, there'd be a narrative for this one part, and then there'd be nothing specific that I was thinking about while I was executing the movement. And then there'd be another anchor, and then nothing specific, and then so on. And as I've performed it, I've filled in all those gaps. And it's not something I intentionally meant to do, but it just sort of happened that way that, oh, that one time I did this arm and I stopped it here instead of stopping it there, and I stopped it with just a little bit more intensity that time, and the music was doing that at that moment, and that just felt so right that I'm always going to do it that way from that point on. And so that's just one example, but that's happened over and over and over.
Yeah, I mean, as a performer, I mean, that's got to give you confidence, got to give you focus, and an ability to, well, feel like you're improving it as you go.
Yeah. And the funny thing that sort of happened after, like, working on that solo for so long and then going into this duet with Kristen, and I essentially decided to make a duet because I said, I don't want to dance by myself anymore. I mean, I do, but at that moment I was ready to dance with someone else. I just want to dance with someone else for a while. And Kristen is someone I wanted to dance with. I had wanted to dance with for a long time. We danced together in school, but we never, you know, had a duet together. But one of the things I started to notice right away is because I had been in solo land making decisions on the spot without having to say anything to myself, not having to communicate it, and sometimes making decisions somewhat unconsciously, I would find that I would expect Kristen to read my mind. And so I would make these decisions or like changes, and then I would turn to her and she just had this look on her face like, what are you doing? And then, but luckily she knows me well enough that she can be like, Helen, I can't read your mind. Like, just tell me what you want.
Honesty, that's nice. Helen Cimino Dance, founder, dancer, choreographer, and educator, Helen Cimino. On May 13th, Helen, along with dancer Kristen Taylor, began their journey bringing Flight Distance 3 Chain Suite to audiences in Canada, Tokyo, and Korea. It's part of a month-long tour with residencies and performances scheduled at each location. The Dance X Tour is presented by the Montreal-based venue Tangente, and you'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Helen Cimino Dance is based in New York and Winston-Salem, and their next local performance will be here in the Triad February 27th and 28th at Hanesbrands Theater. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and when we come back from this short break, it's time to take off our hats to Johann Sebastian Bach. Rob Frazier has gathered a team of Baroque specialists from all across our state and beyond to bring the best of Bach to the Triad for one glorious concert at Centenary United Methodist Church. You'll hear it first right here on Triad Arts Weekend, 60 seconds from now. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Centenary United Methodist Church in Winston-Salem has championed the arts for decades, and recently appointed Director of Music and the Arts, Dr. Robert Frazier, carries that tradition forward this weekend with an ambitious all-Bach program Sunday night, May 19th at 7:30 in the UMC Sanctuary. On the program, Bach's Orchestral Suite in D Major, his 5th Brandenburg Concerto, the Ascension Oratorio on the 178th anniversary of its premiere, and more. Rob has enjoyed a rich professional background as a conductor, organist, composer, and singer, and has led to many musical collaborations. This weekend's concert is no exception. In it, Rob will be using Bach's music to build an artistic bridge between communities and elevate the performance standards of this wonderful literature, utilizing some of our state's finest period instrument and vocal performers. He'll also showcase the creative genius of 3 leading early music conductor scholars, including North Carolina Baroque's Francis Blaker, Greensboro Vocal Consort's James Bates, and Bach's conductor David Tang.
This orchestra is the North Carolina Baroque Orchestra. These are folks who own instruments that are either replicas of old instruments or are old instruments that still play. And the string players, of course, are using gut strings, not steel strings. Mm-hmm. And the bows are constructed very differently.
Sure.
So the sound that comes from a Baroque violin is very different. You know, above and beyond the fact that our pitch standard is no longer 440, it's 415.
That's right. Now, talk about that aspect of it. When people think of tuning the orchestra, you hear the oboe come out, he or she will play that A440, and the orchestra will tune to that A. How did it shift from, and by A440, we're talking about beats per second? How did it shift? How did tastes change from the Baroque period and the acceptance of an A being much lower than today's A?
Well, you know, Baroque pitch wasn't necessarily A415. That's really become the practice of our performance generation. But during the Baroque era, you could travel from village to village, and the A was different depending on the recorder maker in the village.
Sure.
So you wouldn't put a recorder band in one village necessarily with another. It was always different. And well, in North Germany, it was high. In Low Germany, it was low. And in Italy, Baroque pitch was high, say, in Venice, and low in Rome. And in France, it was all over the place. Then it depended on whether it was a chamber group or whether it was an opera. And then, you know, pitch was set. But, you know, setting pitch is really more convenience for the traveling musician, so that when you go from village to village, you have a standard. And, you know, that was probably standardized in the late 19th, turn of the 20th century. A440 became the standard, so that musicians can travel across the pond. You know, instrument builders can build instruments that, especially woodwind instruments, that can easily adjust.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, strings can adjust beautifully to any pitch standard.
Organs less so. Now, how do you navigate that then? You bring in an orchestra, playing period instruments and tuned a certain way. Do they all then tune down to the organ in this case?
So that's a really good question. In our case, we might have had to do that, but I'm bringing in a portative instrument so that we can tune that instrument perfectly at A415.
Okay.
And not have to worry about that particular adjustment.
And the harpsichord?
Because harpsichord the same. We have a transposing harpsichord, which means that the keyboard can slide over one pitch to play at A415.
How about that?
Or if you had, you know, a modern instrument group on Monday night, you could slide the keyboard over and the instrument would play at A440. So that's the way our modern instruments are made, harpsichords are made, to accommodate.
Nice.
And so we are using a Daud instrument, which is transposing for this instrument, which is a French double. It's going to be beautiful. I can't wait to hear Susan play.
And of course, what a great vehicle for her, and the Brandenburg 5, an amazing showpiece for harpsichord. Vocalists, a little less trouble transposing with their natural pipes.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
Two great soloists for the oratorio. Glenn Siebert.
Glenn Siebert, of course, is well known to everyone in this region with Magnolia Baroque. I think he was the founder of that. And then the soprano soloist is a friend of mine who won the National Met, I don't know, in the early 2002 or three.
Oh, that little thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Not bad.
Beautiful person and an extraordinary singer. Yeah. And we've collaborated on projects like this before. And she was a choral artist in residence for me when I was serving Myers Park Presbyterian Church in Charlotte, North Carolina for many years. And now it is on the vocal faculty at Catawba and UNCC.
And by finalist at the Met, we mean she was a finalist in the national, essentially international singing competition for the Metropolitan Opera.
That's right.
And an amazing feat, incredible competition in that
regard. Yeah.
The orchestral suite in D major kicks off the program, which is a fantastic one, with Brandenburg Concerto No. 5, the Ascension Oratorio we just referenced. And you'll have to help me out. You're a German speaker. Give me the German on the last. Der Geist hilft unserer Schwachheit auf.
Der Geist hilft unserer Schwachheit.
Schwachheit.
Auf. BWV 226.
I can say that one, BWV 226.
That's motet number 2 from the 6 motets. And it's we chose it because this particular motet was written for Pentecost. And May the 19th happens to be Pentecost Sunday.
Perfect.
And sometimes you'll hear this piece sung by choirs. It's a double chorus piece. You'll hear it sung a cappella or with just a continuo group or a band of instrumentalists doubling the vocal parts. And we're choosing the latter, to have the instrumentalists since they're there to double, because we have it available. So we're going to plug it in and see how beautifully it comes together.
And the beginning with the orchestral suite, all music by Bach, Johann Sebastian Bach, I should point out, he had 20 kids and many of them famous composers as well.
That's right.
What, just talking about the suites in general, looking at Baroque practice, what were audiences back in the Baroque, in Bach's day, thinking about these things in the audience?
Yeah, of course, I think most of it's stylized dance movement. Mm-hmm. And I think the composers very much had that in the back of their heads when they were composing music. Music to dance by. You know, whether, of course, I would love to have been a fly on the wall to observe the premiere of any of these works, and who knows. Yeah. But these were the forms that were in the air, and these were the kinds of forms that people were latching onto and composing music, using that as a vehicle and putting it together into a suite.
And these suites, we're talking about groups of, you know, a jig, a sarabande, different dances of the day. And I've read that Bach himself liked to shake his booty now and again.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure he did. The genesis for this whole project was the Ascension Oratorio. Mm-hmm. And when we were talking back in January about a project to collaborate on, I said, wouldn't it be great to just, since May the 19th is kind of the anniversary date of when this work was first heard. 278 years ago?
278.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be cool to do this work? And so we found out what the orchestration was for this particular work, and then we built our program based upon the orchestration so that we could make best use of the instrumentalists that would be hired to come in and be with us for the weekend. So we have people, you know, flying as far as San Francisco. David Wilson, whom I was in school with at Indiana University, a very, very fine Baroque violinist, is flying in. He'll be our concertmaster, and it's just a wonderful guy, and knows so much. He's just had scads and scads of wonderful experiences, and he has such an elegant way of working with the strings and getting them to come together as a team. And it's a nice collaboration between conductor and concertmaster. Yeah. Like, he just has such a wonderful way, and it just makes for a lot of fun.
Now, back in Bach's day, he would have been doing the dual role, right? Conducting and performing.
Probably.
Principal violin. Put it in context, the oratorio, its use in Bach's day, and then the Ascension, where does it fit into his output?
Well, it was composed in 35, so relatively late, during his Leipzig appointment, and it would have been a cantata that would have been sung in the context of worship, and as a matter of fact, it's 11 movements, and the sermon for the day would have been inserted after movement 6. So we won't have a sermon on our concert day. And of course, the instrumentation for the work was probably based upon instrumentalists that were available that weekend. So, and it's a grand orchestra, 3 trumpets, timpani, flauto traverso, 2 oboe, bassoon, and then, of course, the complement of strings with basso continuo group.
It's a big group.
Yeah, it's a very big group, which is why we thought if we've got this big orchestra, we might as well do Orchestral Suite number 3 and Brandenburg 5 and...
Brandenburg 5. And now, is Brandenburg 5 the one with the big harpsichord solo?
Yeah, it's the big harpsichord solo.
That is was a continual player yourself. I mean, it's right. like every harpsichord player's dream or nightmare. Right. That sets up the ascension, which immediately follows that, and we get a chance to hear a remarkable keyboard player who, I mean, I was familiar with in terms of organ playing, but going from organ to harpsichord, what's that transition like?
Yeah, well, it's different. I mean, you can't make the assumption that an organist or even a pianist can play the harpsichord with success. You know, harpsichord players that play solo have studied harpsichord because the technique for playing the harpsichord is very different than playing piano. It's more akin to organ, and if you've had training on a tracker action instrument, you know, actually feeling that place within the action where the action causes the tracker to then make the pipe sound. I mean, it's different on harpsichord in that you're pressing the key and the string is actually being plucked.
That's right.
So you can't bring your modern technique, your modern piano technique to the harpsichord and expect it to sound like a skilled, you know, player.
It's a lighter
touch. Training all of these things. It's a much lighter touch.
And Susan Bates, more than familiar with both instruments at United Centenary.
Beautiful player, and has had, of course, training in harpsichord as well as organ and piano. So.
Well, if you're a harpsichordist, I can't think of any other piece you'd rather play than the amazing cadenza in the middle of the Brandenburg's Five, a work that probably wasn't even performed in his own lifetime. It was too tough.
Probably. And it might have even been improvised on the spot, the cadenza, you know?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was another thing about Bach that people really, an amazing improviser on
Incredible.
All of his instruments.
Incredible. The story I like most was the story of Bach with a string instrument accompanying himself at the organ on a trio. So playing the bass line with his feet and
the whole concept of improvising a fugue, it just blows my mind.
Yeah, I know. And there are very few people, you know, in the 21st century that can do that well. And I know some that do it quite well.
Mm.
But it's that, you know, I've often wondered what it would be like to just immerse myself all summer in the art of learning how to improvise fugue. I think it would be a lot of fun. And a good friend of mine who does do it well said that he was able to connect the dots on all of that when he began to teach counterpoint. And once he began to teach it, what seeped in at a new level for him, then he was actually able to realize it on the spot.
And organically absorb it all.
Yeah, exactly. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, to study it's one thing, but to be able to teach it, to really understand it well enough that you can impart that to students is another. And then to take that to the keyboard and experiment with it, I think would be a lot of fun.
Centenary United Methodist Church Director of Music and the Arts, Dr. Robert Frazier. His All Bach concert is Sunday night, May 19th at 7:30 in the UMC Sanctuary. It truly is a best of Bach performance with his wonderful orchestral suite in D major, jaw-dropping Fifth Brandenburg Concerto, awe-inspiring Ascension Oratorio, and joyful, challenging Motet No. 2. Guest soloists include tenor Glenn Siebert, soprano Christina Peer, harpsichordist Susan Bates, and you'll find more information at WFDD.org. Just click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and coming up in just a bit, it's a brand spanking new edition of Care Off at the Keyboard. Turns out another big Bach fan was a slight and sometimes sickly Polish gentleman by the name of Frédéric Chopin. Peter Karoff will take us on a guided tour through just about the most beautiful homage to Bach you can imagine in one little Chopin prelude. And equally inspiring is someone who dedicates her life to sharing the world of music making with children. Greensboro Youth Chorus founder and artistic director Ann Doyle is one such person, and she's here to preach to the choir next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this is a little old segment we like to call Understanding Classical Music with Karoff at the Keyboard.
There's the beginning of a beautiful, kind of somber piece by Frédéric Chopin. It was composed about 1830 or so, and it's called simply Prelude. It's one of the 24 preludes that Chopin wrote in homage to J.S. Bach, who wrote his own famous set of 24 preludes about 100 years earlier. Now, the Chopin preludes are wide-ranging. I mean, some of them are huge and stormy. And some of them are kind of dreamy. But I'd like to talk about this one in particular for a couple of reasons. First of all, it was one of Chopin's favorite pieces of his own, actually. He asked that it be played at his own funeral after he died in 1849. Seems odd. It's such a simple little thing. But let's take a look at it and see how it gets its emotional power in spite of its great simplicity. For example, if you look at that melody, there's really hardly anything there at all. Just a note. And the next note. It's sort of stuck on that one pitch. And then the left hand, you have these beautiful harmonies falling. That's one of the things that gives it its somber quality is the fact that all of the notes of the chords keep changing downward, only downward. This note goes to here. This note goes to here. This note goes to here. And so it's a series of sighs. Again, that static melody. Those powerful emotional harmonies that are filled with dissonance, some altered notes that give it a little bit of edge, a little bit of bite. Now, a little bit later in this piece, the melody comes back. But this time, it's as if the person almost didn't have the strength to say anything earlier, but now the melody opens up, it blossoms, and it turns into this very emotional outburst. Back to that contained, almost repressed level. So it's a little gem, isn't it? A little miniature, very, very powerful in spite of its very, very limited means. Chopin confined himself to just a few notes in the melody, just a few notes changing in the left hand in the harmonies, constantly drooping, that one outburst in the middle. And yet, at the end of his life, as he looked back on all the grand pieces that he composed, it was this one of all that he asked to be played at his own funeral. Very moving to contemplate, inspiring as well. Prelude in E minor by Frédéric Chopin.
Wake Forest University professor and Steinway artist, Mr. Peter Kiroff at the keyboard. Thanks, Peter, for sharing that absolutely gorgeous piece of music. Wow. Well, this is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and more music next as we move from the keyboard to the chorus. For more than 30 years, UNC Greensboro graduate Ann Doyle has been serving North Carolina students, churches, and community groups as a master teacher, mentor, collaborative performer, and adjudicator. 25 of those years have been spent leading the Greensboro Youth Chorus, and on Saturday night, May 18th, you can help celebrate that quarter-century mark with beautiful song. The Greensboro Youth Chorus's 25th anniversary concert begins at 7:30 in Christ United Methodist Church. The performance is free, and it'll feature the premiere of new works by Tom Shelton and Andrea Ramsey. Greensboro Youth Chorus founder and artistic director Ann Doyle spoke with me recently by phone from her home in Greensboro. Was there a major takeaway from that particular discipline?
Well, I always enjoyed a one-on-one, approach to piano, and I thought it was so fascinating to watch the young singers move quickly into the reading aspect of Suzuki. And so I always felt like it was just so valuable to get them to play and enjoy playing before they had the experience of moving into music. But when they did, it was very quick.
That's interesting. That seems to be an emphasis across the board, this joy of the performance. They're playing for other people.
Yes. Little four-year-olds and five-year-olds and six-year-olds playing the piano and loving it.
I'm wondering if you could give us some perspective on the terrain, how it's changed a little bit over the years in terms of, where monies go and how we could make it such that there's an emphasis on what you do in the schools.
I would funnel money into the arts in the schools. It's been so depleted in my lengthy career. It's been just a lot of going over to other subjects and taking away from the music and the dance and the arts that we used to have early on.
Could you give us an example or two, anything that jumps to mind, just to contrast the state of the arts in education today versus back in the 80s?
Well, I can even go back further than that. In the 60s and the 70s, every child in the public schools had music at least every week and perhaps sometimes every day. And that is a very big contrast from where it is now. They just aren't exposed to that wonderful general music palette as well as singing.
What does that do to a student?
Well, sometimes you get a student in the 7th and 8th grade who come to our group and they don't know how to read music at all. They don't even know the symbols. They don't know, they might be able to sing a tune, but they're very far behind in singing, reading the notes and knowing the language.
You're calling on background as an accompanist, choir director, organist, associate director of bel canto for a time. How do all those different disciplines within music inform your work with the Greensboro Youth Chorus?
I've just loved music all my life, and I have passion for it. And I just think it's all connected, because the more experiences we have, the more we can offer to others. And I was actually a band person growing up in my high school years.
What was your instrument?
I played the trumpet and the French horn.
Wow.
I love that. And then when I got to college, I did play a little bit of horn, but then conducting and piano came above that. You just can't do it all.
Are there some suggestions you have for parents that would like to get their kids involved in music? How do you go about it? Any rules of the road from that perspective?
Well, the younger the better, I think. If they start them in kinder music programs, if they have them sing in their church choir, just have the experience. Just get them out there in groups that they can experience, just like in Suzuki that we talked about. Get them to listen more. Get them, the parents, to take them to kids' concerts all the time. There are opportunities for younger children to go listen. An example, EMF has programs in the summer.
By EMF, you're referring to the Eastern Music Festival.
Yes. The Greensboro Symphony also has programs that they take into the schools. It's just, so vital, I think, to have them exposed to those kinds of wonderful concerts. Because what do they hear all the time if they don't hear it in their home, if they don't hear it with their parents? And I love all kinds of music, but principally they don't get the experience of hearing choral music unless they have their parents to back them up.
Because today I'll be sad, I'll be dancing, I'll be dancing, I'll be dancing.
How long have you been directing the chorus?
I founded it 25 years ago.
So 25 years. I mean, one of the advantages of establishing a group like that is you get to bring in so many new qualities to a group or new experiences, one of which is new works. And new works, very unusual, at least in my experience, for youth chorus. Why is it important to you?
Oh, I think we have so many wonderful new composers and established composers in the United States and around the world that are doing a wonderful job of writing for young singers. One of them, of course, is one of our favorite composers, Tom Shelton, who was with us for over half the time that we have been in existence and has now left us for another job. But that's one of the composers that we have to premiering three of his pieces at our concert. The other is Andrea Ramsey, who has just finished her doctorate at Michigan State, and she has written a wonderful piece for our concert as well, and gave us a wonderful day of composition ideas and wonderful training on her piece back in January.
Tell me about the composer workshop with Andrea Ramsey. What sort of interaction was there with the students?
The students came in, and she actually taught the piece to them, which was just so exciting to see how she brought out all the wonderful text of the Madeline Lingle text that this piece is written on. And the kids just had a great time, especially that this is a woman, because a lot of the composers that we know and they know are men, and just an exciting experience for them.
What sort of insight do you think that gives kids to see, to work in collaboration with someone creating a piece of music? It seems like that might be a real eye-opener for a young
kid. Well, interesting that you say that, because soon after that, we launched a poem contest for our singers. And this was the request of Tom, who also wrote a really interesting piece called Animal Imagination. And it's the perspective of if I were a kiwi or if I were a giraffe. And it's very whimsical. And so one of our singers, Lucy Jones, won the poem contest. So her text is put together in this beautiful piece called Animal Imagination. This triggered our singers to what they could possibly add to become a piece. So it was great that that process took place at and around that composer workshop and gave them an idea that they could be a part of this too.
25 years doing this, what are you most proud of?
I think that I'm proud of seeing the thread of how singers develop through the years that we have them, and how, in the end, that they have that love of singing for a lifetime. That's what really pleases me.
What sorts of non-musical things come to mind that former students have gotten out of the experience and carried care with them forward?
Oh, I think it's teamwork, discipline, learning to work toward, the same goals, accepting responsibility as individuals and as a part of a team. All those are great accomplishments, I think, for young people.
Tell me about the audition process for Youth Chorus, and what are some of the ways students can prepare for the auditions coming up?
The audition process takes about 30 minutes. They come with their parents. Their parents are taken to a separate place while we audition the children, and they are told about the whole program. The parents get the information that they need to register and to sign up and any other information that they have questions about. And we group them in four or five to a 30-minute segment by age. And we have them warm up. We talk to them. We let them tell us all about themselves. And then we warm up and sing together. And perhaps if they're at the level of reading, then we see if they can read a few measures of music. So we're trying to get the placement where they should go in the three levels of choirs that we have.
And those three levels are grouped by ability, age, both?
Yes, both.
So just to give us an inkling, what are you looking for in the audition process?
An interest, a clear singing voice on pitch, And of course, we love it if they can already read music. But if not, we can teach them.
Greensboro Youth Chorus founder and artistic director Ann Doyle. Ann's also choir director and organist at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church. But this weekend, it's all about the Greensboro Youth Chorus's 25th year and an anniversary concert featuring the Jubilate, Chorale, Cantabile, alumni singers, and four premieres. Music by Tom Shelton, Andrea Ramsey, and much more. The performance is Saturday night, May 18th at 7:30 in Christ United Methodist Church, 410 North Holden Road in Greensboro. You'll find links to Greensboro Youth Chorus audition information and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. That's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. WFDD intern Caroline Potter produced the Greensboro Youth Chorus segment we just heard. You'll find podcasts, archived episodes, photo links, and more on our website, WFDD.org. Just click on Triad Arts Weekend. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.